Good morning.
Morning.
If it pleases the court, my name is Barty Martin. I represent appellant Billy Colburn in this matter, who's appealing the summary judgment dismissal of his case by King County Superior Court Judge Janet Helsin.
You want to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. It's our position that there was substantial evidence supporting the premise that David Trees, the defendant in the case, was negligent in a cause of the accident, and it was error for the court to dismiss the case. There, as briefed, there he committed a multitude of traffic violations. He sped, his speed was twice the speed limit. He had admitted himself to driving 40 miles an hour in a 20 mile an hour zone. He admitted to failing to reduce his speed prior to entering into a blind intersection. He acknowledged that he didn't know what the speed limit was. In addition, he failed to properly signal a turn. As briefed, he was in the lane behind a Metro bus that was stopped for a left-hand turn, approaching it at approximately 40 miles an hour. He did not signal his change till approximately 30 feet behind the bus, and he didn't initiate his turn until 20 feet behind the bus. I believe I included a calculation that would have been a half a second before impact that he signaled, and a third of a second before impact that he actually began his lane change. Billy Colburn had already begun his left-hand turn at the point that that lane change occurred, and he witnessed, as he was passing through the curbside lane, Mr. Trees change lanes abruptly and then accelerate into the intersection.
Now, this is he could observe this under the bus?
As thank you, Your Honor. As he approached northbound 23rd Avenue East, as he approached the intersection of East John, there's a slight grade. It's slightly uphill. So as he approached the intersection, he could see underneath the bus, but by the time he reached the intersection, it had leveled out, and he could no longer see behind the bus. While he was approaching, he could see, and 23rd Avenue is a very straight street, mm-hmm. He could see three cars, oncoming cars in the curbside lane, approaching in the opposite direction. He could see the bus, and he could see Mr. Trees in the inside lane approaching.
So what was he watching? Was he watching the bus? Was he watching the vehicles as they one at a time entered the intersection and went through it? Or was he watching Mr. Trees?
My understanding is that Mr. Trees was slightly behind the other three vehicles. I presume I
right.
would have to
So he's there, so what's he watching?
When Mr. Colburn is at
yeah, there's
the
three
intersection.
You've mentioned three different things that were going on
mm-hmm.
that required his attention in order to make a determination of whether it was safe to proceed. You've narrowed this down to a matter of 3 seconds or less. What was he watching?
Well, and this is corroborated by an independent witness, he first was watching for the three cars to pass, the three oncoming vehicles to pass. After that happened, before he began his turn, he viewed Mr. Trees approaching the bus from behind and witnessed Mr. Trees get very close to the bus. At that point,
and then was there some point when the bus blocked his view of Mr. Trees?
It did. When he began,
and so he had no obligation to wait for the bus to clear before he moved, so that he could see what was happening coming from the other direction.
Well, Your Honor, he did proceed, and he did inch his way into the curbside lane so he could see if the lane was clear. And having already established that Mr. Trees had not engaged a turn signal, he believed that Mr. Trees would not change lanes and go forward.
Was he entitled to act on that belief with the bus sitting there?
Your Honor, it's our position that he was.
Why?
For a couple reasons. I understand that Harris Burnett states that if an obstacle will move that's impeding your view, you have to reasonably wait for it to move. In this case, the bus is
another vehicle. It's occupied, and it's capable of moving. How does that not fall within the Harris versus Burnett discussion?
Well, I believe there are facts that distinguish it. First off, there's facts that make the bus make it a safer turn. For instance, the bus is substantially longer than most vehicles that would be at a
stop. So the impairment was greater.
The impairment, the obstruction to his vision would have been greater, but the lane, there would have been a much longer lane that was clear, a long stretch of road because of the bus, because as Mr. Trees acknowledged, the bus was at least 40 feet long.
Well, I can't pick up whether, now it seems that you're arguing that there was somehow a greater opportunity for things to happen because the bus was long, before we were emphasizing how quickly everything happened.
There was a longer stretch of road, the stretch of road that Mr. Colburn viewed to ascertain whether or not it was safe to proceed with his turn was longer because of the length of the bus.
I mean, the obstructed part was longer.
Well, both the obstructed part and once he began his turn and could see down the curbside lane after he had inched down, that was a fairly long stretch of road. So I would like to point out that in Harris v. Burnett, the court...
You want to go into your rebuttal time?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to go into...
I would just... the core issue in Harris v. Burnett was whether or not he discharged, whether the driver discharged his duty and did everything that he could reasonably done to avoid the collision. And in this case, him witnessing Mr. Trees not change lanes, if Mr. Trees had lawfully engaged his turn signal, it would have been approximately, 160 feet from the bus, or 120 feet from the bus, and approximately 160 feet from where he was. That's four times the length of the bus and about half a foot, the length of a football field. The likelihood that he would have seen a turn signal engaged would have been much greater, and it's uncontested that he violated the
violation. When you come back, you can answer for me why this doesn't apply to your case. And the quotation is, if the obstruction that blocks the view of the disfavored driver is one that reasonably can be expected to move, such as another occupied vehicle, then the disfavored driver must permit the impairment to his view to move on so that he can see the stretch of the road from which a favored driver might be approaching. So when you come back, start with telling me why that doesn't describe what happened here.
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Meredith Sawyer. I represent David Trees. I want to talk about three things as quickly as I can. I first want to discuss the relative duties at play here, given the right-of-way that was in my client, Mr. Trees' favor. I want to talk about plaintiff's inability to establish duty or proximate cause, and I want to talk about why the deception doctrine does not apply here. I think you focused implicitly on one of the most important aspects of this case, is that my client, Mr. Trees, was the favored driver here. He had the right-of-way. Mr. Colburn was the disfavored driver. He had the primary obligation to avoid this collision. This is sort of an unusual situation because here Mr. Colburn is the plaintiff. He's brought suit against the defendant. Usually it's the reverse. So while in the briefing, plaintiff argues that all drivers have a duty to exercise reasonable care, but those duties are not relative, and the disfavored driver has the primary duty to do this. The right-of-way does not hinge on whether or not the favored driver is proceeding lawfully. The favored driver does have a duty. That duty is not triggered until the favored driver knows, or in the exercise of reasonable care should know, that the disfavored driver is not going to yield the right-of-way.
What's the evidence here on when that occurred?
There is no evidence, and that's the problem. There is no evidence. The only evidence before the court is Mr. Trees testified that he did not know that the plaintiff was not going to yield the right-of-way until the moment of impact. And there's no other evidence before the court on that. Plaintiff's counsel has argued in his briefing that Mr. Trees should have known that the plaintiff was not going to yield the right-of-way when he made his lane change. But visibility is not the same thing as the favored driver's knowledge that the disfavored driver isn't going to yield. And in fact, there's all kinds of situations where we're at intersections and we can see the disfavored driver and we are anticipating they're going to turn left. But the point where the favored driver should know that the disfavored driver is not going to yield, that's the relevant inquiry. And there's no evidence before the court on that whatsoever. There's no evidence when Mr. Trees should have known that the plaintiff was not going to yield. And because of that, his duty to do anything to avoid this collision was not triggered. Secondly, that lack of point of...
Was Mr. Trees' ability to see Mr. Colburn affected by the presence of the bus?
Yes. And in fact, the evidence...
Did Mr. Trees have any obligation not to enter the intersection because the bus was in the next lane?
I would say no. I would say Mr. Trees, it was a green light. He made his left turn lane. The evidence in the record is that he actually engaged his turn signal. There is evidence that he didn't engage it 100 feet back, but he did engage it. There's evidence that Mr. Colburn doesn't know whether he engaged it one way or another. He has the right of way. He has the right to proceed on his green light unless he has some knowledge, or he should have had some knowledge, that the left-turning driver was not going to yield. And this lack of point-of-notice evidence also affects the proximate cause element of the plaintiff's claim. And that analysis is detailed in the Whitechurch decision. Essentially, even assuming Mr. Trees was speeding, you can't establish that speed was a proximate cause of the collision unless you know the point at which, in terms of distance, that the favored driver should have realized the disfavored driver wasn't yielding. There's no way to compare what a reasonably prudent favored driver would do with Mr. Trees' actual behavior unless you know that point of notice. And that's spelled out pretty clearly in the Whitechurch decision. The plaintiff also argues that Mr. Trees was negligent. He cites a lot of statutes, but it all boils down to an improper lane change. And he argues that if Mr. Trees had engaged his turn signal earlier, then Mr. Colburn would have realized he was changing lanes, would have seen the signal, and wouldn't have made the turn. And I would argue that that's just pure speculation. There's no evidence in the record to support that. There's no declaration testimony from Mr. Colburn. There's no declaration testimony from any deposition testimony from any experts. And the fact of the matter is he didn't see the turn signal that was engaged at 70 feet. So it's hard to understand how he would have seen a turn signal engaged 100 feet even further back. That's just not a reasonable conclusion to draw.
What's the evidence in the record on how long it would have taken Mr. Trees to bring his vehicle to rest without striking Mr. Colburn's vehicle?
There is no evidence in the record whatsoever on that issue. That has not been addressed by either party. Although I think plaintiff's counsel tries to make an argument about sort of time, distance, human reaction time, but that's just argument. That's not actually evidence in the record.
So there's no evidence in the record with regard to the time it takes to observe, appreciate, and then respond, and then for the response to become effective?
There is no evidence about that. There's just Mr. Martin's own argument about that, but there's not actually any evidence in the record from an expert or any deposition testimony or declaration testimony from either of the parties. I wanted to address the deception doctrine sort of briefly here. In response to our summary judgment motion, where we argued that the plaintiff really couldn't establish the elements of his negligence claim, the plaintiff argued that the deception doctrine applied and that the defendant was liable for deceiving the plaintiff, essentially arguing, trying to use the deception doctrine offensively and trying to impose liability on the defendant for deception. And I would argue that the deception doctrine doesn't apply in this context. The deception doctrine is a defense. It's available to a defensive driver who's been sued for negligence. It allows the disfavored driver to escape a finding of negligence, but it doesn't impose negligence. Even if you find deception, it doesn't impose a finding or a determination that the favored driver has been negligent. And I'm unaware of any cases that have used the deception doctrine in an offensive manner.
Do we need to address that issue, in your view, in order to affirm the ruling made?
No, I don't think that you do. But it was a very significant part of the plaintiff's opposition to our motion for summary judgment, and that's why I addressed it. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. I've got you 2 minutes.
With a question.
Okay, you've had 8 minutes to contemplate.
Unfortunately, I was also listening to the arguments being made. If I can just briefly address a couple of the arguments before I get to that. One, defense counsel cites no authority whatsoever in her argument that the deception doctrine cannot be used defensively. In Chapman Claxton, the court actually implies that it can be, stating in that case they found that because the disfavored driver wasn't seeking to recover damages from the favored driver, it wasn't applicable. The inverse of that, obviously, is that if the disfavored driver was, it could be applicable. That's at 859. There is an abundance of evidence that Mr. Trees was driving inattentively. That is another traffic infraction that would support him being at least partially negligent. And it's really for the jury to determine fault in this case. There are a lot of facts.
What's the answer to Judge Dwyer's question?
Okay, the answer to Judge Dwyer's question, first off, is the first prong of the defense of the deception doctrine, is supported by the facts. So regardless what the clear stretch of road ruling is, that it certainly meets the requirements of that. As far as the move, I would just distinguish the facts between Harris and the facts in this case. In Harris, the obstruction were children on the road. In this case, it was a Metro bus. The children were moving. It was a danger. The court actually addressed the fact that the driver swerved to avoid children. Beyond that, I don't. And we would ask the court to reverse based on the briefing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last up today is State versus Markinson.